Hello and welcome to Culture File with me, Luke Clancy, and our latest collection of files from around the island and the world. And this week, what making music should smell like, how sometimes loving Beethoven and your country can be a dangerous combination, why Dublin pub Grogan's is filled with art, and how to understand the mysteries of Swift's in the latest Naturalist bookshelf. But we begin with the fragrant music of Moving Still, a Saudi-Irish DJ and producer born in Saudi Arabia and now based in Dublin, creating music without borders. Louis Scully reports.
So, my name is Jamal. I am a producer DJ called Moving Still. I'm also a dad, I'm a scientist, and a husband. I was born and raised in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. I went to school there up until I was 14. I studied mostly in Arabic. I kind of juggle both scientist and DJing and producing as part of my day-to-day activities. My mom is very into 90s dance music. She used to bring cassettes over from Ireland, like the now 53 or now 43 or whatever they're called. And then at the same time, my dad was listening to a lot of Arabic music. It was a really amazing upbringing because at one hand you had like your Arabic music and then also you had all your 90s dance. And I guess I never thought until I was much older how those two influences were kind of nearly meeting together for me to create what I'm currently doing as an artist and as a producer. Most of the time, Arabic music, unfortunately, like cassettes, the quality is never that great. And I remember playing an original of Sari SOS in the Sugar Club, and I couldn't believe the response. Even though the quality was terrible, the response of the crowd, including like, you know, Irish people, Arabs, African people, everybody just went bananas to it. And that moment basically was, I need to do something with the song. For me, it's quite meditative to do an edit because everything is already there. You're basically respecting the original, using extra elements to bring out the main essence of the song in order to be playable on today's dance floor. And it can actually resonate in those big speakers in clubs or festivals. It was post 9/11, you know, it was 2004 when I moved here. So obviously the rhetoric surrounding Arabs in general was quite bad. You know, there was like stuff that was in movies that was just like very strange, or cartoons, even like lyrics of songs, they were all just like very inappropriate. And as a kid, you kind of want, you don't know how to navigate that. So what I ended up doing for a long time is nearly suppressing that part of me in order to be kind of feeling belonging to my Irish side. And I think after a while, that does actually break something inside you. And I think over the years, as I was growing up, it nearly felt like there was something missing. And if it wasn't for music, I would have never brought that part of me out. When I released my first song, I had literally no idea that people would actually even care or even like it. I was doing it for myself, and I was pleasantly surprised to see how many people were just interested in that sound. The amount of Irish heads that show up to these gigs, they're like, I haven't a clue what that chap was saying, but that was a banger. And that's the kind of feeling that you want on the dance floor. I done a DNA test a couple of years ago. I'm like literally 30% Egyptian and 40% Irish, and the rest is like a big mix of everything. So I'm quite inspired by Egyptian culture. So I've been really into listening to a lot of Egyptian maharajanat, which is basically festival music. It's street festival music. And I love how they play synths. They're incredibly fast, they're incredibly high energy. I can't write music that quickly, so I have to slow the song down completely and then speed the track up. I try to bridge stuff that I would say is, you know, electronic music from Irish culture mixed in with synthesizers from the Arab world or the Swana region, and I try to amalgamate that into one to create my interpretation of if those two worlds met, how would they sound. The whole point of what I'm trying to do is I want everybody literally sweating by the end of that set. As a kid, I absolutely loved the smell of oud. Obviously, it's very pungent. It's an oil-based fragrance that comes off a tree, mostly made in India or Cambodia. It's a resin that comes off this tree. I don't know the exact science of it, but it's like a fungus that grows in the tree, and the resin that comes off the tree then creates the oud. And then obviously this is harvested and is used for spirituality, and it's basically used for, I'd say, most of the Gulf countries like Saudi, Qatar, the UAE, Bahrain. A lot of the music that I make, or even the names that I come up with, are based on fragrances as well. Before I make a tune, I usually put on either perfume or the oil-based fragrance, and depending on the fragrance, I could make something completely different. Like when I was living in Saudi, my uncles used to carry these little small bottles of oud in their pocket, and as a form of respect, they used to take out the bottle, and it has like a little dabber, and you take out the dabber and they would dab you, for example. And now you are like stinking of this oud. Like you would smell like this for days. Now, obviously very pungent, it'd be hard to get onto Dublin bus with a very strong smell like that. But I'm really passionate of those smells. They have been part of my life for a really long time. And I think that musically, it really does inspire me. And it is just something that I feel like I want my children to be part of.
Moving still there in that report by Louis Scully. Next, we're off to the pub, but not any pub. Instead, one of those pubs that, outdoor terrace notwithstanding, has proved resistance to the gentrification that has shaped the streets around it in central Dublin, offering not just a sanctuary for old-school verbals, but a unique art collection, as Quiva Lavelle reports.
Situated on the corner of St William Street and Castle Market, a stone's throw from St George's Street Arcade, it's a spot where, come rain or shine, you'll see folks filling up the smoking tables outside, running into pals, enjoying pints and toasties, and practicing the fine art of the good chat. Inside, a cosy lounge with walls teeming with art and tables full of interesting characters, artists, writers and messers, dissecting the issues of the day and holding on to the good seats.
My name is John Moynes. I'm one of those people who drinks in Grogan's. And so I came into Grogan's because my friend, the late Tom Garvin, had said he used to drink in here on a regular basis. And so I thought I'd stick my head in there, see if he's around. And he was. And not only that, but he was sitting with Tom Matthews. But Matthews was someone who I was a huge fan of. And Garvin and Matthews were sitting there having a chat. And it occurred to me that they were great friends. So I inveigled my way into the conversation and then discovered that this place was full of what I can only describe as interesting people. And that's what I've always loved about the place.
My name is Michael O'Loughlin, and I first came to Grogan's when I was 17 or 18 as an illegal drinker. So that would have been 1977, 1978. I didn't really like it because it was full of horrible old literary people, but you had to come here sometimes. And Anthony Cronin actually used to come here as well. And then I kind of rediscovered it in 20 years ago. The fact that there's no TV, no music, no sports, horrible old people sitting around, you know, Most of whom are now dead. But it's great when, like, you see older people dying. It makes you feel younger. You know,
it's easier to get a seat as well.
It frees up.
Someone being funny. It's actually called the departure lounge.
Most people that I used to know here are dead. Yeah. Isn't that right, Tom?
Yes, it is.
You're alive.
Unfortunately. Well, yeah, I seem to be by some trickery, yeah. Yes.
But a friend of my daughter's, I met her, and she said, "Oh, I know you from Grogan's." And I said, "What? I never saw you." And she said, "No, we sit along the wall and we look at you." So I think the older people became like the attraction, almost, that younger artists would come just to look at us, you know, and soak it up. Yeah. And I think that was designed that way by Tommy Smith, almost. He's kind of like, he's grooming the next generation. The generation after the next generation, even. I think it's great that he put up art. And it ranges from the sublime to the ridiculous. And that's kind of partly the point, that there's no, like, quality control. Now, I've actually bought paintings in here for my sins. Really.
Tommy's generosity did not stop there. He was a man who, as they say, did good by stealth. There were many people who benefited from his generosity. He was one of those great kindly men.
Doing good by stealth. If we were to take a wander upstairs above the pub, you might find artist Orla Mellon, serenely working on a painting in the upstairs gallery space, as she was when I called in.
Hi, my name is Orla Mellon, and I'm a contemporary artist living in Dublin, Walkinstown. There's a printed element to the work that I do. You know, there's I love pattern and I love texture, so it's a very graphic kind of style that I paint in.
I chatted with Orla all about this upstairs space and what's been going on here.
The first time I came in, it was covered in art. No floor space was left. It was just full of hundreds and hundreds of art pieces. You couldn't walk anywhere. It was just full of it. And Donal Smith, Tommy Smith's son, had asked me, would I like to, or could I sort out this mess? So I was like, right, give me time to think about it. So after a time of reflection and thinking, how could I sort it out? I said, okay, I'll have a go. But Paddy Kennedy and Tommy Smith, whenever they owned the bar, they were really, you know, advocate for the arts, and that's where the whole art came from. You know, they used to have the exhibitions in the bar, and then they would change it over in for the Christmas show, so all of the work would come upstairs, and everybody was told to come and collect their work, but a lot of work was not collected, and that's where it accumulated over the years, was all of the artwork. And yes, so you can imagine that was a lot of art. And I recruited Aidan Kelly, a photographer, so he could archive all of the pieces of art. He could photograph it and I would archive it. And some of the art, well, a lot of the art didn't have names on the back, so I was just writing the description of the piece and, you know, the materials that were used and if it was damaged or, you know, what size it was. At the end up, I think we had over 900 art pieces, you know, ranging from oil paintings to photography to mixed media pieces. There was everything. They painted on fabric. There was a piece dated back 1976. And with that artwork then, so we had the auction on the bar, in the bar, and then we had the online auction as well. So people could bid online and then come in and collect their piece. And then the money raised from the auction, we put the money together for the hospice in Harold's Cross, where Tommy Smith spent his last few days. When I was sitting in here, like, it took a year to archive everything. And when I was sitting in here, I could see the light coming through the room. You know, the light was just amazing, and I thought it would be an amazing gallery space. And we mentioned to Donal and Owen had this vision of, you know, transforming it, and he transformed it to the space that it is today.
Yeah, I mean, there's the old joke about two people meeting in Grogan's, and one says, "I'm writing a novel," and the other says, "Neither am I."
Quivel of El there alongside those people who drink in Grogan's. Next, we're off to a spot north of Jerusalem. Later this month, Banat al-Quds, a choir of women from the West Bank in Palestine, tour Ireland. They're led by composer and conductor Suhail Khoury, one of the founders of the first music school in Palestine, the Edward Said National Conservatory for Music. He spoke to Culturefile's Niamh Daly.
I am Suhail Khoury. I am the president of the Edward Said National Conservatory of Music in Palestine. I'm now in Bir Zeit University, 16 kilometers north of Jerusalem. I think I'm privileged to have been brought up in a family with musical background. My mother used to sing in a choir. My aunt is a composer. My mother's cousin is a composer and musician, and he was my first teacher. So I started early learning music when I was 6 or 7 years old. And in Palestine at that time, there was no music school as such. So there were few musicians who had, went to Europe in the 40s or 50s and came back and were teaching music. Of course, there was Arabic traditional music that was being transmitted from one generation to the other by oral tradition. Like people learned 400 years ago in Europe, maybe, you go to the musician and you sweep the floor and do the dishes and then learn. But as a formal music, as a school of music, that didn't exist at that time. So I learned at the beginning some violin, but teachers were visiting. So a couple of months here, a couple of months there. And then the cousin of my mother came back, Amin Nasser, who's a great composer, came back from Jordan in 1970 and started teaching. He taught piano and clarinet. And I was one of two clarinet students at that time. Everybody was learning the piano, of course. And from the early beginning, I was really interested in classical music. We used to have record players at home. And my mother tells me that when I was 4, I used to just, stand in front of the gramophone and move my hands as if I was conducting the Berlin Philharmonic or whatever. My mother tells me that I used to love Einklein Nachtmusik by Mozart. I also used to like Beethoven, but I used to also listen to Palestinian folklore in the village. I used to go and listen to weddings happening, and that made up what I am now, I think, this combination of all these musics.
So tell me about the Edward Said National Conservatory of Music.
Beginnings were in 1990 when Mrs. Rima Tarazi, who is our chair emeritus, she's now 93, she asked four other musicians who had trained in classical Western music to come together and make a committee and make a study about the situation of music in Palestine. She already had decided that we have to have a school of music if we really wanted to move forward in doing a difference in musical life in Palestine. We opened for children, of course. To start teaching, you have to start with teaching children. And then 20 years later, the university program started. So in 1993, we started, and we started with two sections, basically a classical music section and an Arabic classical music section. And it grew rapidly. I mean, the interest was enormous from the people.
Do you think that there's an inherent politicization of a music education or to be engaged in music? Because in your book, Loving Beethoven, you said to only love Beethoven doesn't seem to bother the authorities. But then once you start playing Beethoven, I mean, I'm paraphrasing here, but once you start playing Beethoven, then you become human in the eyes of the world, and that becomes an issue for the Israeli authorities.
I wrote this after my wife and myself got arrested in 2020. I run the conservatory. She used to run a cultural center with concert halls, and she used to promote culture. So I said this was the threat, basically. The main accusation was that we promote Palestinian music. Of course, what else would we promote? The music itself, I mean, the teaching of music is not political, but, you know, being under occupation and expressing yourself becomes political, whether however you express it. The Israeli occupation does not have any difficulty in dehumanizing the Palestinians and showing them as violent people and terrorists and all of that kind of image. But when you see the Palestine Youth Orchestra performing in the you know, Royal Albert Hall or the, you know, Royal Festival Hall in London, and they're performing Beethoven or whatever classical, other classical piece, and just wearing their Palestinian scarf, this gives a totally different image, and this destroys the all the propaganda work that Israelis try to dehumanize the Palestinians. Daughters of Jerusalem, they sing songs, and the songs are political and are social and are full of hope and full of, you know, earning for freedom. But you can do that, and you can just play music. So basically, it becomes political because it becomes threatening to the Israelis that all of a sudden there is a people like any other people, and people who can, you know, play their music and play other people's musics and deserve to live in freedom. This becomes political, even if you don't say anything in the songs. Being there as a Palestinian, the people then start seeing you as what you really are.
Suhail Khoury there in that report from Niamh Daly. Banat Dalkud will perform at the Pavilion Dunleary on the 26th of October, University Hall Limerick on the 28th, and the Whitler Hall Belfast on the 30th. And finally this time, the Naturalist Bookshelf, from which Paddy Woodworth has taken down a relatively fresh but no less magical volume.
It takes the whole universe to make the one small black bird. Mark Kopker reminds us repeatedly in his daring, challenging and uplifting book, One Midsummer's Day, Swifts and the Story of Life on Earth. He bases his thinking on John Muir's great principle that if you want to understand one thing in nature, then you must at some level understand the entire universe from which it has evolved. So, on the one hand, Cocker's pages are a passionate tribute to his obsession with every aspect of swifts. Those birds that epitomize flight more than any other genus, sleeping and even mating on the wing, and coming to earth only very briefly to breed. On the other, his pages are replete with detailed, diverse, but always relevant knowledge and awe at the physical and geophysical processes that makes such a life possible at all. To start with the swifts themselves, he writes poetically but precisely about their unique life stories. Consider this passage about the common swift's transition into adult life. The choice they face is to abandon all that they have known in their 6 weeks' existence for everything that they will ever become. Gloom for sunlight, a cobwebbed corner for an infinity of air, gravity for weightlessness. And when, he continues, they cross the threshold and acquire their species' 49-million-year-old faith in that maternal void, the emergent chicks will not just fly for the first time. They will fly and fly. They will continue to do so all the way to sub-Saharan Africa. Is there, he asks later, any greater transformative magic in all bird life? The 49-million-year reference calls into play the other great arc in Cocker's story, his macroscopic account of how life evolved in our solar system, interplaying with his microscopic examination of the behaviour of dozens of species of swifts right across the world. The two arcs meet over 36 hours in his English garden. During that period, when what he calls the common swifts' evening social screaming parties reach an intensity that indicates migration, another of what he is not embarrassed to call one of nature's miracles. The great arc allows him to explore in fascinating detail a dozen aspects of our whole solar system, from its remote stellar depths to the bacteria in the air we breathe. He begins with the birth of our sun, and in particular with the origins and impact of our moon. He attributes the changing seasons and all that accompanies them to the gravitational effect of the moon on our relationship with our mother star, the dance that we experience as the change of seasons. Our hemisphere, he writes, this country, my garden, are on a journey back to autumn and winter, and the swifts will soon follow the dwindling warmth and sunlight to the south. His arc takes in half a dozen detailed accounts of phenomena as diverse as the role of insects in our ecosystems, whose current population collapses threaten every other aspect of life, not least that of swifts, which, as he points out, wryly, in one sense are insects themselves, since they eat no other prey. It enables him to espouse the priority of symbiosis, or cooperation, over crude competition in the still lively debates of evolutionary biologists. The book is infused with the spirit of Gaia, the sense that the Earth is in some sense a single living, interdependent organism. But this does not leave him starry-eyed. Towards the end of the book, in a single, highly elongated sentence, he unblinkingly documents the terrifying multitude of human-induced threats facing life on Earth. He insists, however, that it is our imaginative failure to integrate science with our culture and economies that is the source of our problems. Mystery and wonder and love and knowledge are necessary to each other, he declares boldly. The most beautiful thing that the mind of humankind has made is a story about life that is true, open to disproof, and subject to endless improvement. So if we are looking for hope, he says, open the door. You are an embodiment, an inheritor of all life's 3.8 billion years of storied heritage. You are hope. And unsurprisingly, the best embodiment of hope for Cocker is the bird whose stories he has told throughout the book, the swift, that one small black bird that it has taken a universe to make.
Paddy Woodworth there with a suggestion for your ideal shelf of nature writing. And Paddy and myself will be hosting Culture Files annual live events at the National Botanic Gardens as part of Dublin Book Festival next month, where our panels will be exploring the idea of the hare's corner and whether insects need a glow up. That's on Saturday the 8th of November, details of which at dublinbookfestival.com. Till next time, bye now.